Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, listeners. We wanted to let you know that Heritage Radio Network's Julia Child Fellowship application is now open. The fellowship offers an enriching experience for aspiring food writers and journalists who share our passion for food systems change. The fellowship is a great way to progress in the field of food journalism and digital media and will start in early January 2024. This fellowship will provide participants with hands-on experience, mentorship, and access to an extensive network of industry professionals. The application deadline is November 27, 2023. Check out heritageradionetwork.org and click on the Julia Child Foundation Writing Fellowship link to learn more. If you or someone you know has interest in food studies and journalism, this might be a great fit. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and check out the application today. Thank you.
I'm Lou Bank.
And I'm Aaron Campos with Dark Matter Coffee.
And this is Agave Road Trip, the critically acclaimed award-winning podcast that helps Green Gags bartenders better understand agave spirits in rural Mexico. And Aaron, so you and I just did this episode where you were talking about trying to source coffee from Mexico, which hasn't been the easiest thing in the world, right? But then you brought up this bit in there about consistency, and that it's impossible to get consistency from one harvest to the next, which reminds me so much of the things that I love in agave spirits. And I thought, like, let's play around with this and see if this can become an episode.
Oh, all right, I'm in.
Yeah, you're always in for playing. So it's fascinating to me that, I mean, obviously you've got these cocktail mezcals where they really work hard to try and make each batch, each bottle taste the same so that bartenders know what they're going to get when they're making a cocktail. But, you know, the spirits that speak most to my heart, if I get a Tobalá from Victor Ramos, which I do every time he makes one, but if I get a Tobalá from Victor Ramos in Miahuatlán, and I get it in 2017, January of 2017, and then I get, you know, another one in March of 2017, those two batches are going to taste significantly different. And it's the same thing with coffee, right?
You know, I have a note on that. Why is it that we have to be careful with bartenders with mezcal inconsistencies from year to year, but chartreuse gets a pass all the time. It's the most inconsistent.
Chartreuse is?
Yeah.
Seriously?
It's from bottle to bottle. Try it.
Well, I do try it. It just tastes like sugar to me. and that was not an insult. I love sugar, which is also my nickname for Connie.
But we celebrate that with chartreuse. Why does chartreuse
get really
the pass? Well, I don't care, but I love chartreuse.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, hang on. So let's go deep on that one. So have you done like side-by-side tastings, like what do they call that, a vertical or a horizontal?
Oh. Yes, but we didn't call it that. We just called it a Saturday night at that time.
but of agave spirits or of chartreuse or both?
Oh.
Because I'm wondering just how different each batch of chartreuse is.
Yeah, we should put that together. I think that would be really interesting. You know, that's one thing I've heard of one of my favorite bartenders of all time, Freddie Sarkis, shout out, love you, man. You know, that's one thing he would always talk about with chartreuse, you know, how people celebrate the inconsistencies from year to year and from batch to batch and bottle to bottle. People just maybe not celebrate, but they're just used to it. They deal with it. It's fine.
I don't believe it's fine and they deal with it. I believe it has to be celebrational.
Yeah.
You know, as you're saying that, guys, so there are all these bars that have vintage chartreuse bottles And I guess that's sort of the point.
Yeah. I mean, and the older they are, the more vastly different they are. I mean, granted, there's oxidation and there's all these other things that happen.
Sure, sure. But it's also...
Yeah. There is a little bit of identity for each bottle.
Oh, I had no idea that was a chartreuse thing. That has me excited. So, but it's also a thing with coffee.
Yeah. So with coffee, you know, it's such a hard thing to really, pinpoint on exactly where that comes from, because it is such a nebulous produce. Obviously, you know, just like every other produce, we're always going to look at how the climate is changing, how weather is from year to year, what the rainfall was like. If the pickers did a really good job of picking the cherries to their ideal ripeness, all those elements are obviously super important. But then you get into, the processing part. So that's bringing it in, making sure that the equipment is working properly. You know, you have to calibrate certain pieces like the depulpers to be the right screen size so you don't crush beans. So is that being done well? You know, the drying, are they using machine drying? Are you using patio drying? Are you doing a combination of both, and for how long? And then on top of that, which that can change from year to year because everyone's always playing with their process, at least the really good ones that are always trying to do better. And then on top of that, what the shipping time was to get to us. You know, you have green coffee. Granted, now in modern times, every, specialty coffee is typically shipped in GrainPro, which is really good with keeping moisture out, condensation, all of that. So there is a protective layer there. But, you can't really protect against temperature, and that can change things. So then you bring it over to us. Now you have the roasters getting their hands on the green coffee. And is it snowing outside? Is it hot outside? What's the humidity like? All of these things are going to change how the roaster is going to react with the beans. And that is going to cause a specific type of adjustment that's going to happen on the quality control side. And then not only that, you might be, what style of roaster are you roasting off of? We have two different types of roasters. We have a civets, which was our identity piece, something that we loved. Fluid bed roasting is something that we strongly preach about. And then we have our Loring, which kind of represents a modern technology for roasting. I mean, it's you can theoretically, we've never done this in practice, but theoretically you can roast a batch of coffee if someone loaded it for you from your house. Different sides of the same coin, but all of these things kind of play into this, all these parts of this equation now equal what your final cup is going to be. And then not only on top of that, Lou, you get the roasted coffee. Now you're bringing it to consumers. Coffee's changing from day one to day two, day three, day four.
And how you mill it is going to change. And the water that you're using. God, this is really, it's so reflective of like the 400 decisions that we talk about in the process of making these spirits.
There you go.
So how consistent do you try to be with this?
Well, I think about it in terms of, so I'll give you one example. So we have a blend called Unicorn Blood. It's we have it in all of our shops.
Man, I just had like and I know this is different because now I'm talking the coffee cold, right? The can, but oh my God, the one that was aged in brandy barrels.
As soon as you told me that, I went back to try it again, and I was just like, oh my God, Lou was right.
I was right. My favorite words again.
Look at that.
Oh my God, that is such good coffee.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that was a really, really fun experiment that was done with our barrel aging program. Kelly, Eric, Gideon, Bones, they have been absolutely killing it on that side of things. And that was one of my favorite projects to date that they've they've come up with.
So back to the idea of consistency then, are you trying to get a consistent flavor, or are you just trying to get within a consistent framework?
Oh, right. So there we go. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. So when we are, so going back to Unicorn Blood as an example, we have, we can have three different components in Unicorn Blood sometimes. And what we're looking for is a flavor profile that, A, we want it, we don't want it to be light and floral and kind of almost like almost too subtle in terms of nuance, because those espressos, don't get me wrong, are delicious when you drink them on their own.
Yeah.
But as soon as you add some milk to them, then they just completely dissipate in the milk and you barely get any of those. We want it to be universal. So when you add it to some milk, you pour it as a ristretto, you're going to get coffee presence, you're going to get the unicorn blood that cuts through, because milk is, really what you're doing when you're adding milk, you're diluting it with some sweetness, some fat, and, that can really, really dilute a lot of subtle flavor. So there's that. Now, again, we have three different components. We are saying, okay, let's just say the blend in this case would be 20%, one thing, 40% another, and then you'd have 40% of another thing.
So when you're saying things, you're talking about varieties or species of
different varieties of coffee and maybe different lots, because some of those blends might be a mixture of different things that are processed the same way.
Oh, it's an ensemble.
Yeah, it could be exactly. But like when we're pouring this now into a grinder, can we guarantee to that exactly 20% and 40% and 40% of each component went into that portafilter, went into the and did that exact thing? No, we can't. But that's why you almost work against yourself, at least in my opinion, when you get hyper specific. I've seen blends that are like, this is 12.5% of this, and to me, that gets missed in the translation when you're pouring it out, because you can't guarantee that,
right?
I think for us, what we're looking for is windows of success. You can see how the coffee is being poured out of an espresso, and you can make judgments looking at how that espresso is being pulled from the actual machine itself. See the color difference. See, is it watery? Is it syrupy? And make a lot of judgment calls based off of sight alone. You don't need to be hyper specific when it comes to weighing everything out, having the TDS at a perfect ratio and all these other things. At the end of the day, to make a really good cup of coffee, you really can rely on your senses to do that. We've been really doing that for our entire existence.
Your five senses. Once again, we're right back to agave spirits. So let me ask you then, to get back to this idea of the different varieties, so 90 some percent of all mezcal is made from espadine, right? 100% of all tequila is made from Blue Weber, though sometimes there's corn syrup. Is there the same kind of thing with coffee, that there's one varietal that dominates, but then there's a Tempestate that people are trying to find? What's the...
Yeah. So, one thing that comes to mind, one of the first varietals that come to mind is Bourbon, which is a funny varietal, because if we are barrel aging a Bourbon variety in a bourbon barrel, then it gets a little funny to
consumers.
Oh,
it's spelled the same way?
Yeah, spelled exactly the same way. But anyway, Bourbon was highly, highly prolific across Central and South America, especially when we started to source. And it still is to a degree. You get a really high yield, you get a really sweet cup of coffee. They put out really, really good spectrum of flavors. However, because of those high yields and because of everyone kind of growing that same varietal, you had a major wave of Roya or rust. What this does, it's a fungus that spreads from tree to tree. And what it does is it attacks the leaf. So when you're looking at the tree, it starts to have the spotting. There's also another disease called ojo de gallo, which does a similar thing, but it looks slightly different. And whatever you're harvesting that year, if the tree already produced cherries, those cherries are going to be fine. However,
if it didn't,
all those leaves are going to fall off and you're going to have a devastating blow to everything else that was being produced. So
this speaks to the real issue of the dangers of monocultures.
Absolutely. I mean, Guatemala had a state of emergency where you had, a vast majority, I believe it was like 75% to 80% of the bourbon just devastated in there. And a lot of people were growing it.
So do you see any of these farmers who are integrating different varieties of coffee into their fields in order to protect?
Absolutely. I would even say that even a step further, even anecdotally from our partner, Federico Pacas and the Pacas family at Duke's Paul in El Salvador, they are starting to work more with hybrids and they're starting to work with more rust resistant plants. Mm-hmm. And, the way that a lot of farmers kind of renovate farms, that might take, they could take upwards, 20% can be aggressive. But they can take upwards to 20% of their farm, rehab that for younger coffees. Mm-hmm. Because it takes about 3 to 5 years to really get enough of a harvest for it to actually generate some income. Before that, there's almost no cherries on the tree. And if they are, it's insubstantial, doesn't really do anything. So you couldn't just theoretically wipe out your entire farm, plant new trees, because then you'd have zero income for the next 3 to 5 years.
Huh. Wow.
So it's a slow game. And we've seen Federico, for over a decade, isolate the issue, mm-hmm. See what's going on and slowly rehab a lot of his farm. Now, when we're looking at, rust, we know that that becomes a major issue on lower elevation farms. Mm-hmm. As you go up, it becomes less of a thing, but it still is. There is still
the threat
of it. Yeah. So you're not out of the woods just because you're in high elevation. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to take us on a different tangent unless you...
Oh, yeah, no. I think that just to your point, people have really started to explore way more of a biodiversity within coffee coffee varieties to really combat that and really kind of, safeguard, their income for their families, for them. And it's been... really, really sad to see happen over this period of time. But then when you see a lot of the biodiversity that's coming out of this, it's been really beautiful, especially just in the sense of trying all these new genetics. That's something that we've really wanted to hit hard and bring to consumers, from the state side is, this is, having a Catoyer from this far versus having, a geisha and what the difference they would be and like why their different varieties will taste so different.
So I'm guessing that one of the significant differences between agave and coffee is that, with coffee, you've got to have a crop every year, right?
Yes.
Like you harvest once a year. And I'm guessing that regardless of what variety you're talking about in the coffee bean, that it's not like there's one that takes 4 months to reach maturity and another that takes 8 months, that they're all on the same cycle.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, there might be some varying degrees, but as broad strokes, yes.
And so then just the last question in this, have you ever seen any communities or any families where the coffee in essence becomes part of the religion? There's an awful lot of just commercial mezcal. I'm not trying to suggest that all mezcal is, part of this cultural heritage that's special and precious, but so much of it is, and so much of what I love about it is. Do you see that ever in coffee?
Thinking about it, I see a lot of it, maybe not in a religious aspect. Have I seen that directly? No, but I have seen major cultural influences, especially, in Guatemala, when the coffee harvest is happening, it is a huge celebration in that local town because this is the time when you have a lot of people now getting income from the pickers and, everyone around them.
Right.
So it becomes a giant festival. And you see this kind of aligned with all these communities that are also part of the pickers and that work at the mill and all of that. Those are really, really big. But that's a really interesting question. I have not come across that myself. But I think it would be highly unlikely it doesn't exist anywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it's funny when you and I and Jesse and the whole crew, the first time we went down to look at cacao, to look at chocolate, I kept wanting to see that. Right. And, yeah. and when you look at the history of chocolate, it feels to me like there should have been some of that, because it certainly was, like, you know, it was the food of the gods. It was the food of the kings. And I thought for sure we'd see it, and I didn't. But, you know, I think that in a way that also speaks to something special about mezcal, about agave spirits, that tradition didn't die in that particular consumption pattern.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the one interesting thing about, you know, going between both is that with agave, it is growing every day. It's becoming more and more well known in America, and you know, people like you, and really more of you than most people I ever met in my entire life, has really been on the forefront of giving consumers like information and educating and bringing people to those farms and having that connective tissue. With coffee, it's weird because it's the second most traded commodity in the world behind oil. So there's a lot of room for corruption. There's a lot of room for taking advantage of small communities and exploitation. And, you know, from virtually every single level of the coffee industry, there is massive room for taking advantage of the next person behind you. Huh. And it's a very, very strange industry to be in, because the more you learn about it, the more you realize there are some amazing, beautiful things that happen in coffee, no doubt.
Yeah.
But there is this undertow in coffee that has like these, you know, these dark influences that you really want to avoid and understand and educate. You know, and it's something that we're learning more and more about every single day that we're part of it. It's a minefield.
You know, I wonder if part of the reason for that isn't that it is so big, but it's always been a presence here, right? Yeah. Like mezcal, although it's, you know, hundreds of years old, it's new to most consumers outside of rural Mexico. Even in Mexico City, it's relatively new. And so it's the opportunity to learn slowly, whereas most people in the USA start their day with coffee and they don't know anything about it. Most people in the USA eat chocolate and they'll tell you they love it, but they don't really understand it.
Right. It's weird. It's such an ubiquitous thing in mm-hmm. our culture that we disassociate it with even being a drug, you know, from everyday use, you know, but it is. It's something that we really depend on. It's something that we allow everybody to consume as a drug in everyday culture, and especially like in office buildings or, you know, working here, you know, it's like that's okay. But it is something that virtually everyone is addicted to. And there's a general source of income that you can always depend on there. And, you know, it's people take advantage of that. I don't know why I got so dark.
Because that's just your nature, Aaron. Okay, well, you know, I think that's a beautiful way to sort of wrap it up, is to think about these things that we consume on a daily basis that we take for granted, that if we stop and we think about them and we look at the different aspects that we don't even know exist, take the time to, that we can get so much more out of them.
Yeah, and to really understand that if we're all going to be able to drink this beautiful, beautiful beverage, someone is going to lose something somewhere. It's a really, really, really tough. Looking at me.
I was trying to make it bright. You got it. You set up an eclipse on me again, Aaron. Okay, so as you're drinking your coffee, I just want everybody to think about all of the other people in the chain that they're harming. And that's the conclusion of this episode. Is that good?
Think critical, you know?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, one of the things I do like to talk about is that, you know, it doesn't matter what we're consuming, unless you've grown it yourself or you walk to the place where it was grown, that you're creating a wake. Right. There's this carbon wake behind you, and that you should be mindful of. It doesn't mean you don't do it, but it does mean, you know, be mindful of it and do what you can to try to clean up some of that wake.
Hear, hear.
Okay. Now we can wrap it.
We can wrap it now.
Okay. Thanks very much, Aaron.
No problem.
Hasta pronto.
You've been listening to Agave Road Trip, the critically acclaimed award-winning podcast that helps Gringex bartenders better understand agave, agave spirits, and rural Mexico. We're blessed with sound engineering by Roy Sierra and a theme song performed by Gabriel Oliveira and Marco Ricos. Sign up to become a road tripper and listen to more episodes at agaveroadtrip.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please let us know. And if you hated it, well, I'm sure you'll let us know that too. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Agave Road Trip. Agave Road Trip is a production of 10 Angry Pit Bulls, Inc. Agave Road Trip is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. To subscribe to the Heritage Radio newsletter, enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with Heritage Radio Network on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find Heritage Radio Network at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization using the power of educational storytelling about food to build a more equitable, resilient food system. Heritage Radio Network couldn't do that without support from listeners like you. Become a part of the world's most innovative community today. Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the Heritage Radio Network family by becoming a member. To become a member of the Heritage Radio Network, click on the beating heart of our homepage. Heritage Radio Network can become addictive. Programming you hear on Heritage Radio Network might lead you to eat, drink, and listen to more programming on Heritage Radio Network. If you drink, please do not drink and drive. Drink responsibly, drive responsibly, eat responsibly too, and listen to Heritage Radio Network responsibly. To listen to Heritage Radio Network responsibly, wear protective earbuds. While wearing protective earbuds, do not drive. Do not walk either. Sit in a comfortable chair. If that comfortable chair has a hard seat, please remember to stretch every 30 minutes. If you stretch every 30 minutes, please stay within your defined stressing capacity. And consult a doctor who specializes in stretching. If you don't have a doctor, maybe Dr. Ryan Acock, the Cocktail MD, can help you out. Thanks for listening.
Agave Road Trip out.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.